Turn this thing on. Okay. Last week I gave a talk on the attachment between the infant and the mother and the parents and the role that long patterns of behavior can be addressed in spiritual practice, specifically Vipassana meditation, concentration meditation, and the tools that we have available to us to work with really old wounds that arise from feeling senses of neglect from childhood. So I'm going to talk this time about some of the other roles in the development of a personality and how our interpersonal identities come about and the role that Vipassana can play in helping us untangle our inner experience, which as we become adults can be very quite confusing. We might often at times of our life really begin to feel a sense of estrangement from who we really are, a sense of a mystery of not knowing what lies beneath all our behaviors, what makes us tick. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Hopefully it will make sense. Maybe it won't. But if it doesn't make any sense, think of it as spiritual stuff. And just assume I'm being deep. all right, so the social identity, the mask that we wear, the behaviors and traits that we present to other people, they can be thought of as a social identity, as a construct that we put together. And why do we put it together? We put it together to win approval, to win acceptance, to win support. It's very scary when we're young and we're introduced into the interpersonal world out there of other kids, of other, you know, the socializing process of schooling and then interacting with people outside of schools and interacting with our family members and the desire to get a sense of fitting in. And one of the, just as in the infant psychology, a lot of wonderful stuff has been developed by people like Ainsworth and Bowlby and D.W. Winnicott and Fonagy. These are all attachment theorists. There's another theory that's called social learning, which is the way we develop interpersonal personalities based on the group, how we relate to others. And this was developed by a guy named Albert Bandura, who was an amazingly influential psychiatrist who wrote in the 60s and 70s, who did a lot of clinical studies noticing how children develop these social identities. And basically, to make it very simple, we're fucking imitation machines, to put it simple. We look around and we see what are the behaviors that are rewarded by the group. If you're a young boy, you might see in certain circles macho behavior or athleticism or being the joker or being outrageous or being transgressive and breaking all the rules, smoking in the boys' room, all that stuff. Whatever circle you hang out in, there will be certain behaviors and traits that are rewarded, that are bestowed with approval and popularity. And then there's other behaviors which are frowned upon. In certain circles, any effeminate behavior amongst boys or any doubt or self-questioning or interest in the arts or dancing or whatever might be not approved of. So there's this desire to, there's an unconscious desire to win approval. And what we do is when we see somebody act out in a way that gets attention and approval, we imitate it. Sometimes we imitate it well, and that's terrific. A lot of times we find out that we're not as funny as the funniest kid or as athletic, which was my problem. When I was a kid and all the other boys loved baseball and shit. And I just have no... I have very little motor coordination skills. Surprise, surprise. So, and I tried really hard because, that's one of the dominant ways that boys reward themselves and develop sort of interpersonally rewarded, achieve a sort of status in the group. So if we're unlucky in that we hunt through a series of other performance-based traits until we hit upon something that we can do. If we can't be funny or athletic, we might stumble upon a group that will reward us for being creative, and we'll try that, or we'll try to manifest things that we see are rewarded until we finally develop a set of traits that are rewarded enough that we can navigate through the treacherous waters of other kids without being too isolated, too left alone. I was exceptionally poor at most of this. I was good at music. That was probably, and smoking lots of drugs. So that was my two dominant skills that I seemed to be able to, drink too. So I managed those when I was a kid. And that was just enough to eke by an identity that wouldn't result in me being completely ostracized. But, of course, as we're stitching together coherent personalities based on all these traits that we've imitated that or that we've cultivated just to get approval, many of which are not authentic. They don't come to us naturally. And then on top of that, there's another process which is internalizing all the Richard Dawkins calls the memes, the common sense and the ideas that are floating around in the world about us. And we try to put all these ideas and these behaviors and traits together in a way that looks nice to the world so that people will like us. And this is the construction of the socially approved construct, the social identity. And the social identity becomes utterly fascinating to us. When people say, oh, I love thinking about myself, they don't mean their true deep inner feelings. They mean they like thinking about how other people perceive them. That social mask. Do people think I'm funny or smart? How much money will I have in the future? How can I make myself have more skills so that I'll be more successful? So we're fascinated not by the inner feelings, which I'll talk about in a moment. We're fascinated by the way we manifest to others, the way we appear externally. This is basically a stage game. It's a lot of work doing this. First of all, just the amount of effort it takes to continue to present and perfect traits and behaviors and thoughts that we're not naturally good at, that we've simply seen are rewarded by the world. I grew up in a family that was extremely focused on academic achievement. My mom was very, very successful and had her career was started by her academic achievement. My sister is a professor at a prestigious institution, and I don't consider myself by any means to be a failure at academic pursuits, but I'm much more of an autodidact. And it was always a very awkward fit to try to live up to that external demand of, you know, getting the marks, the grades, the procession of achievement within the academy. It was a very awkward fit for me. So we spent a lot of energy trying to piece together, and we often completely lose track of all the inner feelings that are arising and passing in the body, the discomfort with the social presentation, the times when what we feel inside doesn't match what we're presenting to the world. For example, a lot of us feel, quite rightly so, that being a caring person of service is important. It's rewarded. It's what other people give their stamp of approval, and why not? It should be. But we're so desperate to manifest this behavior that we often don't notice when we're completely empty inside, when any connection with any authentic, deep feeling of concern or compassion has dried up. And rather than go about refiring this inner compassion, we just go through the steps of pretending. We don't notice when there's this disconnect between what we show the world and what we feel, what's really occurring inside, what thoughts, what moods, what energy levels, what body sensations are occurring. Very often, the sensations we carry in the body are very inconvenient. You go out on a date, you want to be funny, you're physically feeling nervous, the heart is racing, and then on top of that, there's the mind going, "Ah, she's not laughing at that. What's the matter? I'm not being funny. I should be more assertive. I should be more this. I should be more interested. I should be less interested. I should talk about myself. I shouldn't talk about myself." So there's all this. And then we haven't even got to the biggest issue of all, which is to use a little bit of Jung, which I'd like to give a shout out to. There's a whole concept of the shadow, which is basically we have a lot of traits that are authentic that aren't particularly, we're not particularly thrilled with showing other people. For example, if we've seen in social settings that being assertive and being very goal-directed and very self-sufficient are rewarded, we tend to push down thoughts and feelings of confusion and fear and uncertainty because these don't fit the plan, they don't fit the agenda, they don't look good on the resume of life that our friends reward. If we hang out with people that are funny and we're not feeling funny, we push down that awkward feeling. We push down anything that doesn't fit the agenda. Very often, of course, the things we push down naturally can be impulses that we don't want anyone to know about. And so they all get mixed together in this soup of the repressed, this shadow personality that we keep down. And then unfortunately, the problem is all that energy repressing doesn't really work. And so people begin to act out on the repressed in really bizarre ways. This is a great, I love this guy. I had a friend who I'm close to, and I'm gonna change the exact details because it's not appropriate to. Anyway, he had a fetish that he really liked to act out on, that he wasn't very, so we'll just say it's like a foot fetish or something. I don't know. Those always sound funny to me, so I like that. So he would go to these stores that actually had magazines for foot fetish. He couldn't just do it on the internet, even though his fetish actually that he could have easily just looked up at home. But it was all part of this process of acting out, because he was so ashamed of it And he was so pushing it down that once a month he would go and he would like buy the foot fetish magazines. And then it was so shrouded in shame and a feeling of remorse afterwards, I guess he would go home and jerk off to the feet, that he then would binge eat afterwards because he was so ashamed that the only way he could then externalize and let go of the shame would be to stuff food, which he would then throw up. So he had mixed all these different things in this circle of shame that all began to, like, through association and through repression, began to get mixed up into this ball that became a ritual for him. And the ritual was entirely based on repression, which was, I am ashamed of this impulse. I have to keep it down. I can't talk about it. I can't acknowledge it to people. I can't have any acknowledgement of this whatsoever. And so that amount of repression guarantees one thing, and that is it's going to come up. It's not going to come up in a way that we particularly like it or makes sense, but the more we're at war with ourselves, the more we compartmentalize, the more we push and shame and reject part of ourselves, these feelings and urges and impulses don't go away. They come up in vastly, you know, contorted shapes. Of course, there was nothing to be ashamed about any of this, but that's what happens. So the end result of confusing our social identity and losing track of the inner feelings and the inner impulses and the body, which is often has an agenda which we don't like, has desires that we don't like, is very much this compartmentalized personality where we show certain people certain roles. Like when we're at work, we're very serious. When we're with our friends, we're laid back and outrageous. When we're at home, we're this or whatever. And so we begin to like erect in the mind these very strict boundaries. And what happens is a couple of developments. First, there's a form of narcissism that can happen, which is we become so fixated and fascinated by the way we're perceived by others, because if so much of our social identity is made up of stuff we've imitated or simply grabbed from others or are manifesting despite their lack of authenticity, we really care about, you know, how do I look to others? How do I look? How am I being taken? Envy can result when we see other people rewarded for behaviors that we wish that we could manifest but don't successfully manifest. We can be jealous of people who are naturally funny or athletic or good-looking in their appearance or the way their assertiveness or whatever. We can feel a sense of jealousy when somebody effortlessly presents to the world a trait that we wish we could authentically and easily present. One of the saddest results is conflict. The entire process of, I think, homophobia, gay bashing, is based upon men who have repressed any feminine or homoerotic tendencies, and thus when they see somebody act out on it, they feel the need to beat it out of them just as they've beaten it out of themselves. So we get in conflict with people who act out on impulses that we are ashamed of in ourselves. The same energy that we take out on them is the energy that we've used to repress. So it's not a pretty picture. I think that the goal of Buddhism is not to just start acting out willy-nilly on any impulse that arises, because that would be stupid. In fact, in Buddhist practice, we place a great deal of emphasis upon not causing harm, upon the precepts of not lying, not stealing what isn't freely offered or taking what isn't offered, not acting out inappropriately through intoxication, not trying to have sex with people that it's inappropriate for us to have sex with. So you get the idea. The idea isn't suddenly acting out or a whole natural, ooh, I just feel it. I'm going to put it out there. First of all, the goal is to, in our meditation, in Vipassana, in our inner awareness, begin to open to these impulses, these energies that we generally run away from, that we hide from. Sexual urges can be urges for, it can be feelings of sadness or anger that we don't like. It could be all these things that we are ashamed of. And rather than acting out or agreeing or letting them dominate, or on the other hand, pushing them down, what we can do is open to what needs attention, which is just the way these energies present themselves. Anger, sadness, confusion, doubt, they all are feelings that exist for real. We don't have to get caught up in the story, though. We can simply feel, for example, anger, which starts, you know, of course, here and then starts moving up the jaw and the forehead, which tries to keep it down, and then it keeps trying to get out of us. There's the feeling of confusion, not knowing, which is a small feeling, and the shoulders contracting and the jaw getting tight, a quivering maybe in the lips. There's a breath energy for every single state that exists in our experience. And the good news is the earlier we open to all of these impulses and traits and feelings, we no longer have to compartmentalize or beat down or repress, because when there's a place where everything can arise and be seen, then there's no longer this war with ourselves. And we can actually be comfortable at times when we're in a group of people where everybody else is being really assertive and aggressive, and if we don't feel like it, we can own that feeling of, I'm not going to compete. I don't have to. The beauty of opening to also the flow of thoughts and impressions and experiences that we begin to see that this identity that we think of as ourselves is nothing but a flow that doesn't really make any sense. And that's okay. The stuff that makes up a human being is not a pretty, even, nice story. I'm a this, I'm a that. And it's this bullshit is foisted on us everywhere. Somebody was telling me about the stuff that they had to write on those dating sites. You know, you have to write who you are and all that shit. Which is apparently largely based on what bands you like. Which is hilarious. But anyway, so we have this need to present constantly this picture of who we are. And it's all bullshit. It's all a largely just, it's not in any way matching what's in here. So we no longer have to be ashamed of what's in here. We no longer have to, we can, when there's no feeling of being funny, of being wise, or of being of knowing the answer, we don't have to present that, even though that's what's rewarded. There's so many meetings I've been to in my life as I worked for years as a art director, and you go to these meetings, and there's certain people who just are they have to be the one with the answer. Every meeting they go in, they're sitting and waiting for their time to give the answer. And it's such a charade, because nobody has the answers all the time. But we love to have this, play these roles. We can also open to the possibility that at the end that we have a whole lot of impulses that just conflict. We all have the desire to grow and change and explore the world and travel. Everybody wants to travel. I don't even know why they ask that. Do you want to travel? No, I don't want to travel. I just want to stay in one place for a moment. Of course, everybody wants to travel. Everybody wants to explore. But we're also allowed to have fear. We can also feel overwhelmed by all that it takes. We can also feel financial pressures. We can also feel uncertainty of what we want to do. For a long while, all of my friends, they really loved going to like the really, really third world countries where nobody had ever been. That was what was rewarded. They said, where have you been? Yeah, I was at Bula Bula, where no white man has ever been, because they're generally killed when they go there. And they'd be like, where'd you go for vacation? I went to the Caribbean. But that's fine. It's okay. There's a really wonderful part of life that happens when we get to a place where we give ourselves permission not to be accepted, not to give up the hunt for approval, to give up caring what's rewarded and what's not rewarded, to open to just honoring how we feel without needing to manifest anything that gets that makes us feel more part of the group. And I think that the ability to do that comes from spiritual practice. Because I know that even if at times people don't get what I'm on about with my friends, that's all right. Because I have in me now an awareness that is open to everything, that accepts everything, that allows everything. I don't have to always be the funniest or the smartest or the most spiritual or the most Buddhist. I can just be me as I am at that moment, which is always changing, thank goodness. We're not, the human identity is not like a car, like a Volkswagen, where you have a set of capabilities that don't really change. Maybe you get a little rusty over the years. That's not the way it works. We're like rivers, different things flowing through us. So we can open to that, and we can see, okay, what's flowing through me today? What have I got going today? What's not happening? It's all okay. That's what Vipassana is about. So one of the things, one of the practices I like to leave us with is the when we sit in our meditation, after we observe all that's arising and passing without interfering, one of the things we can do is simply ask first just the question, who am I? And just sit there without any easy answers. Just allow that question to resonate. And then, what am I? What needs to be felt? What am I ashamed of? What makes me uncomfortable about myself? Just sit with these thoughts and just open to not the quick answers, but to the feelings, the generative feelings in the body and the breath that arise. Purposely go to what makes us uncomfortable, the things that we've been pushing down. Open to them, embrace them. The next time we find ourselves with an energy that we really don't like we're really, really wanting to shout or stomp out or judge or we're just angry and we don't like it, then rather than act out on it and rather than push it away, just go inside. What needs to be felt? How can I feel this? How can I honor this feeling without acting out, without pushing it down? How can I just be with this energy? How can I allow it to arise and pass? It's the third way, what the Buddha called the middle path. We don't act out, we don't repress, we give awareness to everything that needs our attention. And by doing so, the beauty of it is that true, lasting inner peace doesn't come from being perfect, because nobody's perfect. It doesn't come from presenting the perfect personality to the world, because nobody's got that. Nobody can. Where true inner peace comes from is from being whole, which I mean embracing ourselves, the energies, the traits, the feelings, all that, just embracing it internally, opening to it. No longer having a sense that so much of me I wish I didn't have, or all those things I wish I could have. It's instead just opening to it. The more we are at peace with everything that arises, the more inner peace we feel. It's the exact opposite of resistance. So that's about it. Hope there was something in there to reflect on. I am going to turn this off.